coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your guest host this week. Very popular, famous comedian, Brody Reed. thank you so much, guys. This happens everywhere I go. Today we are joined by film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good with you?
Hi, Brody. Welcome. What's good with me, the Met Ball was this past week.
Yes.
Thank you. I worked really hard on that. Tons of fascinating conversation on Twitter about what camp is and isn't, which as an elderly gay man, I really enjoyed. But I wanted to give a special shout out to Gemma Chan, the gorgeous star of Crazy Rich Asians and Mary Queen of Scots, for wearing a Tom Ford headdress that was directly inspired by the thing that Elizabeth Taylor wears in the movie Boom, which is a must-see film. And I'm going to segue into a bit of a plug here. Shout Factory is actually releasing Boom on Blu-ray at the end of May, and I'm on it in one of the extras talking about the movie. So,
very cool. I was so confused that it was camp and no one was like dressed like a cadet, you know? No one had like badges or anything.
I would have worn a pup tent.
Exactly. We're also joined by a film critic and host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, April Wolf. April, what's good?
It took me a while, but I figured out that what is good is Celine Dion.
Ooh.
Always. Okay.
I forget about Celine Dion, and then sometimes she shows up in my timeline on Twitter. I'm like, oh, that bitch is wonderful. Because she came to the Met gala, and like, you know, Alonzo was talking about, and I love that I read that they asked her, you know, like, oh, what's camp? And she's like, I don't know what camp is, but, and it's just like, bitch, you are camp. I'm so excited that, like, you're the only person who counts because you're the, like, you are camp.
Yeah.
And you don't, like, that's and what
part
camp
of camp is.
Is
not knowing that you are camp.
Yeah, so, yeah. She's the only one who pulled it off because she's like, I'm just wearing what was in my closet. And you're like, I know.
You win.
Yeah.
I hope to rise to that level someday. And lastly, we're joined by our special guest. He's a TV writer whose credits include Harvey Girls Forever, Dawn of the Croods, Robot Chicken, and The Simpsons. Please give it up for Brendan. Hey, Brendan, what's good?
Being here, this is awesome. Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah. I'm going to suck up so then I can go shamelessly into a plug right before I headed over here. So, new season of Harvey Girls Forever is coming out soon, and we wrote a whole bunch of fake boy band music for this season, because we have a little boy band supergroup of, like, Nick Lachey and Joey Fatone and Joey McIntyre and Sean Stockman. It's super fun, and all those songs just went up online, available for download.
Wow.
And I'm super... We wrote these a while back, and just super, super proud of them, and super happy that they're out there in the world.
We'll put a link to a SoundCloud in the description.
Is this your first songwriter credit?
A few other ones from some of the songs. I got to join BMI off of, I think, some songs on... Dawn of the Croods, but now I'm really expecting to know Lachey is going to carry me a lot further.
Totally.
Heck yeah.
Brody, what's good with you?
What's good with me?
I was drinking water.
I know.
Damn,
I
you took
to
that
take
chance.
Advantage.
You know, not much, just doing comedy. And I have a podcast that is coming out soon called The Dark Weeb. It's an anime podcast with my friend Cody Ziegler. And I'm very excited about that. But right now, I'm very excited to just be with you guys, my new best friends.
Oh, wow.
On today's show, we'll be discussing the new Seth Rogen film, The Long Shot. We will answer a call from the Who Shot Ya line. And as always, we've got staff picks. But first, it's time for a new segment called It. Short for Is It Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is It Important? Do I Care? We'll find out. Biggest thing that happened to me personally this week was the Sonic the Hedgehog redesign controversy. You guys all know, but the Sonic the Hedgehog, the trailer came out for the new live-action movie. It was released, and reactions from fans was extremely negative. The biggest criticism was of the way that Sonic looked, of course, and most people complained that the filmmakers tried to make him look too realistic, whatever that means. I mean, he doesn't look like a hedgehog to me, personally. The director,
searing realism.
The director of the film, Jeff Fowler, has heard complaints and has tweeted out the following statement. Thank you for your support and the criticism. The message is loud and clear. You aren't happy with the design and you want changes. It's going to happen. Everyone at Paramount and Sega are fully committed to making this character the best he can be. Hashtag Sonic movie. Hashtag gotta fix it fast. And I do appreciate that hashtag. The film is scheduled to be released in November. So, is it important? Do you care?
What I find disturbing about this, as somebody who has zero connection to Sonic, so like teeth, no teeth, I got no dog in this
all
hunt.
All teeth.
Sure,
just
why
like,
not?
Just all
a
teeth.
Big rolling ball of teeth.
Made of human baby teeth.
This just kind of makes sort of vivid a thing that I've really hated about the internet for the last 10,000 years, which is this notion that fans feel like they have a say in the finality of art. You know, like everybody on the internet is Annie Wilkes, and they are holding, you know, that author from Misery hostage on their bed, and they want things to be exactly the way they want them, and if they don't, they're going to, like, you know, hobble you. And so, I mean, in the specifics here, redesigning Sonic may well be a very good idea. I just don't like this notion that we give fans this much power.
That's interesting. Yeah. I gotta agree with the internet on this issue. because I mean, like, the people who are actually making the decisions on Sonic's character design, I think, are probably just suits. You know what I mean? I could almost guarantee you that every person who, like, worked on the actual design of this Sonic movie was just like, he doesn't look like Sonic, and the suits were just like, make him look more real. This is just my own theory, but the Sonic fandom has a pretty huge online presence of people who like to make their own characters or, you know, more perverted stuff.
I was going to say, there's some Sonics that you do not want to Google.
I was going to say, it's basically all I know is the weird shipping, but yeah.
Right. It's a pretty beloved design, I think.
Yeah.
That's if they're the ones who are going to pay to see it, I guess in this instance, like, there's certain kinds of, like, comics and game stuff that, like, I don't know, just maybe bow down to the fans because it's truly fan service.
Right.
It's like, why would you? You're not going to convince my mom to fucking see it in Michigan. It's not going to fucking happen.
I wanted to say my one thing, because it's generally, I'm like fans all the way on that. It is going to fucking murder the animators and effects artists.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. That was my big reaction. Was like, no, unless this is tied to, and we're pushing the film 6 months.
Yeah.
It's just going back to what you said, Alonzo, of that if we're giving fans that power, that also gives suits that power to, like, not actually do their due diligence early on.
Yeah. Because
you are totally right. This is the whole crew, I am sure, was like, no. But they kept going. Now, like, oh, don't worry, we can still fix it. And those poor artists are going to be just dead.
That was my initial thought, too. But then on Twitter somewhere, I saw somebody who works in this field basically saying, oh, no, this is actually kind of it's a find and replace sort of thing. Like, once they sort of redesign it, it's pretty easy to sort of overlay it and make that change. But I don't know. Maybe that was a suit lying. I have no idea.
I hope so. I hope all those people get bonuses for sure. But I think it'll be funny once they, like, redesign it and then people really maybe hopefully even love the redesign and then watch the movie and is like, oh, this is bad.
Oh, wait, this still sucks. Yeah. Oh, damn.
So we shall see.
Can I read the next one?
Absolutely, please. Do.
Please.
Okay. Because I was like, ooh, I didn't know this. God, I love gossip. In a recent Vulture interview with Angelica Houston, the actress said a number of very provocative things. Among them, she defended Woody Allen and Roman Polanski and said that she would work with both of them again. Wah, wah.
Oh, man.
But she also had this to say about her own career. Quote, I'm looking for movies that impress me in some way, that aren't apologetically humble or humiliating, like Band of Cheerleaders gets back together for one last hurrah, you know? An old lady cheerleader movie. I don't like that kind of thing. If I'm going to be an old lady, and I'm sort of touching the old lady thing these days, at least I want to be a special old lady. And for those of you who don't know, there is a, quote, old lady cheerleader movie that's coming out called Palms, starring Diane Keaton, Pam Grier, and Jackie Weaver. So when asked by Vanity Fair what she thought of Houston's comments, Jackie Weaver had this to say, quote, I just laughed and then I said, well, she can go fuck herself. I would say she must be going through menopause, but she must have had that ages ago.
Kind of hard to get on board with the rebuttal, and it's also throwing women under the bus.
Lady on lady action here.
I don't know what to think about this.
Well, is it important? Do we care?
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to diss a movie and, like, you know, when you're making it that obvious which movie you're dissing, then, you know, you open yourself up to this kind of thing.
And yeah. It's
like, but I love that shit because that's old Hollywood shit. Yeah. Like, that's what people used to do in old Hollywood tabloids all the time. They would just diss each other.
Right.
And it's like, I don't mind that. I kind of like just being a person and not just being handled by PR.
I can get on board with
yeah.
your talking.
Yeah, no. I'm thrilled about it. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying this is what happens when you do it.
And I think it does need to be done at this caliber. Like, I love the level. It's just delightful, both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird to establish yourself as on the side of Roman Polanski and then be like, maybe I'm right on this old people cheerleader movie.
I mean,
haven't we seen enough of this?
I mean, her dad was also kind of a womanizing director, so she may come at it from another angle. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, she probably not didn't get fucked up with because her dad was very powerful,
right.
So.
This one.
Oh, yeah, that's a fun one, too. All right.
Oh, please. The director and producer, Joe Carnahan, perhaps best known for directing Smoke and Aces and The A-Team, is going after critics who didn't like the newest film he produced and co-wrote, El Chicano. Film critic Carlos Aguilar wrote a mixed review of the film for the LA Times, which technically counted as a fresh review on Rotten Tomatoes, and Carnahan went after him on Twitter, writing, "It's because you suck as a writer. This
nice.
Motherfucker is proof that the days of Pauline Kael, Roger Ebert, and Andrew Serres are dead. Mexico City ain't East LA, homie. Your, quote, review, unquote, missed by miles. Should have had Justin Chang review El Chicano. He's from Orange County, gets it, and is 10 times the writer." Carnahan then went on a rampage tweeting at a bunch of other people, deleted those tweets, then issued this statement before deleting his account entirely. "I deleted the offensive tweet, but it's fascinating how many of you, quote, critics, unquote,
people who criticize me, quote,
like it's your job or something, rushed in to defend one of your own like some tribal council. Maybe look at that, at the fear and loathing you live in because of your reluctance and or inability to create yourselves. Is this important? Do you care?"
Wow.
I love this. This is hilarious. Like,
what a fucking prick.
And we should say Carlos is a lovely human being. He's Mexican.
It is not a good look for the white guy who co-wrote and produced El Chicano to come after a Mexican film.
Yeah, to big up him saying Mexico City isn't East LA and then call him a homie.
Real weird. And also, he's just a great film writer and he's really, thoughtful. And I think he gave this movie very thoughtful review.
Mm-hmm. And again, like one of the few positive reviews has on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's who he goes after.
It's very even-handed.
It's bananas. And then I love the follow-up tweet because I love when somebody says something stupid and then follows it up with, "Well, the real culprit is all of you guys for getting so offended." Because, a certain web blogger, whom I will not name, did the same thing this week where one of the producers of the film that we'll be talking about tonight, was doing kind of an Ask Me Anything on Twitter.
Oh, the writer, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he left this just really obnoxious tweet that I think ended with saying, like, "Your film sucks donkey balls," and then later apologized for it because everybody was like, "Dude, you could have just said nothing." Say nothing is an option. And then, of course, he had to follow the apology with, "The jackals on Twitter who came after me, blah, 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 blah." It's like, could you just, say you said something stupid, walk it back, and go home. Like, it doesn't always have to be about your the people who are rightly pointing out that you're being an asshole are not themselves assholes.
There's a lot of people pointing out I don't know. There's just a lot of assholes on Twitter right now.
Yeah, there are.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say. But apparently critics are villains.
Yeah. It's crazy to shoot your own movie in the foot this way. I mean, you could not have said anything.
Yeah.
It's not like he heckled you. You're going to get a lot of bad movie reviews, dude.
You think you'd be used to them, actually.
Yeah.
He's had some experience.
After he cited Roger Ebert, somebody pulled out Ebert's 1.5-star review for The A-Team.
I respected that,
There's so much of this going on lately of people being really thin-skinned about criticism, and I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what criticism does and why it exists and what it's motivated by. People are taking this like this sort of personal attack or, he brings up the hacky old canard that, we're all film critics because we can't create anything. And it's like,
fuck you.
Tell that to the French New Wave.
I would love to read a film review that's like, "I'm crying right now because I couldn't do this, but
I'll never make a movie.
I'm quitting, and I think that this is the way to go out.
I'm a phony."
Yeah, that movie convinced me.
So I think we're going to take a break, and then we're going to get back to talking about the movie that we all came here to dunk on. Personally,
speak for yourself.
I have a lot to say about this movie. So let's take a break.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your guest host, Brody Reed. In the studio with me are...
No!
Whoever wants,
no!
Whoever
Alonzo
wants to go first.
Julie. April Wolf.
Brendan Hay.
Alonzo Giraldi. It always starts with you.
Where no, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't.
After the first break, it does.
I love this Mexican stand-up that we're
having. Oh, man.
This El Chicano stand-up.
Where politeness falls apart.
Joe Carnahan has some notes for you. Yeah.
So today we're talking about The Long Shot. Brendan, since you're our guest, could you please provide a brief synopsis of the film?
I could, I guess. All right, so Long Shot is about... Secretary of State, played by Charlize Theron, who learns that her not very great president is not seeking a second term, so she's going to run for it herself, but something about approval ratings for a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. So conveniently started also a parallel story of her old neighbor who she used to babysit, Seth Rogen, is a very liberal journalist who has recently lost his job, but is also very funny and charming, mm-hmm. and they cross paths, and she's going to hire him to punch up her speeches. They go on the campaign trail together, and rom-com ensues.
Rom-com ensues. That's how I would describe this movie for sure. It's a weird one for me. I really wanted to like it. Definitely went to the theater with a grin on my face, and the guy was like, it's pretty funny. I was just like, oh, great, I'll take the ticket. And then I went in, and then I rolled my eyes pretty hard for about 90 minutes. Mm. It's kind of like it's definitely like the skeleton of a rom-com, and then so Charlize Theron, she's like an incredibly powerful woman, which is like a thing that I liked. It's a dynamic that you don't see in rom-coms a lot, and mm-hmm. I did enjoy that. And everyone tries, I'll give them that. But it didn't work for me for a couple reasons. It's a movie that's like about politics, but is very apolitical, and the cast, even though it's like it's a great cast, I don't feel like anyone was really utilized well. I think there was a little bit of good chemistry between the leads. O'Shea Jackson really tried, but I do not think he made me laugh one time. How do you guys feel? I don't want to be the only one talking about it.
You're wrong. I loved this movie from start to finish.
You loved it?
I loved it.
Wow.
I thought it was hilarious. It reminded me of what it is that rom-coms do well, and it made me sad that we don't get more of them lately. But I felt like it gave me a couple that like there were reasons for them to be together, but they were valuable. They're not valuable, but there were genuine things keeping them apart, which is, you know, interesting and provides the conflict. I think their chemistry is great. I thought there's a really funny supporting cast. I thought O'Shea Jackson Jr. is pretty good. I really like June Diane Raphael.
Yes,
you know, I was charmed by this film, and I agree with you that they are playing it safe when it comes to politics, which is a thing that movies like this tend to do. I was reminded of Rob Reiner's The American President, mm-hmm. where the whole backdrop of the legislation that Annette Bening is trying to get passed is environmental. Because I think, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is the same thing she's mm-hmm. trying to do in this movie. Because yeah. I think we can all agree that, yeah. you know, like, trees are good.
It's kind of like a cute politics.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They're not going to get into, like, foreign policy or, you know, economics or anything, like, heady or controversial. So I kind of accepted that early on. Like, okay, this is where we're going. This is a mainstream
I wish movie. I could have accepted that. I'm just curious to know when this movie was written. If I had to guess, I would say, like, 2015. It's weird to have the president of the United States be a character who is just, like, kind of a goof and, like, has ambitions to... be a famous like actor. That's one of the plot points of the movie.
Well, he'd been a TV. He'd played the president on TV, which is how he got elected. So right. I thought
that was interesting. A confusing introductory scene for me. I gotta say,
I thought that was an interesting Trump parallel because he got elected for playing a rich guy on TV.
I was 50-50 on this movie, yeah. but I actually liked that. I thought that worked for me.
I mean, you're right. It seems weird to be making kind of a fluffy movie in the world of politics when the actual world of politics is so fraught mm-hmm. right now. But again, you know, I think with rom-coms, you sort of willingly enter into a somewhat nebulous zone where nothing's going to get too angry or too, you know.
Wanted to... like willingly like agree to that, like get into that rom-com feel, but like it just didn't capture the things for me. There were some earlier establishing scenes where you're supposed to like get to know the character. There's like maybe like a 3-minute scene where you just see Charlize Theron go through like her night and day routine, and it's like set to like Sims build mode music and it
that is so deep. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to have to, like, Google it. Like,
it's just
like,
Sonic the Hedgehog.
Just kind of, like, white public music, like, public library jazz. And the whole thing just, I kind of, there were points where my eyes wandered from the screen, and I didn't care if they went back until the next scene started.
I felt like, so the writing to me, I felt that there were jokes there, and sometimes they didn't land, and it made me wonder if it had to do with the directing. I don't know that the director knew what movie they were telling.
Well, that's because the tone of the jokes kept changing for me, and that was actually, because I'm 50-50 on mm-hmm. it, I actually like the chemistry between them and most of the supporting cast a lot, and that carried it for me. Because I have a political issue that I'll get to in a moment that mm-hmm. bummed me really hard later in the movie. But the maker thing
was...
I might
have that one, too.
But then the other thing is, joke-wise, it felt like it was like, here was a draft that was very much in the Dave American President vein. Yeah. And then, like, okay, when certain people signed on, here's the kind of Farrelly draft over that.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so we have jokes that are, like, really broad, scatological jokes on mm-hmm. top of, like, things. There's one or two jokes that were, like, political. That's like, that's actually relatively subtle or nice, or then it's just like good relationship comedy type of or like between characters. None of them really lined up, and I don't think Jonathan Levine ever quite got it smoothed out that they felt like one piece.
It's worth pointing out, it's funny that y'all both used the phrase 50-50, which Jonathan Levine directed.
I love that movie. I was surprised to find out.
Did he also write that one, though, too?
No.
Who wrote that? Was it Seth Rogen?
Well, this one was written by Dan Sterling, who did the interview for Seth Rogen. He wrote that one. And then Liz Hanna, who co-wrote The Post.
Yeah.
So, you know, what you're talking about, the sort of clash of things.
Very funny movie, The Post.
But The Post was some of the tone. Like, I could see that, and I was like, oh, that's working for me. But then the tone would shift, and mm-hmm. I'd be like, that's sometimes working for me.
He did not write 50-50, just to be
clear. Oh, okay. Yeah, you could tell that maybe there were two different writers in it.
Yeah, and I agree on the tone very much. It felt, if the script felt broad to me, and I don't think that the script was bad, but like because it felt, I think you guys would agree that it was kind of goofy. Like if they let it be a little bit more goofy, it just didn't feel like, it feels like they showed up on the day and forgot that it was supposed to be like a fun, goofy movie. Some scenes.
I don't know. I mean, look, for me, I hear what y'all are saying. I thought that the movie kind of represented sort of what you expect in a Seth Rogen movie versus what you might expect in a Charlize Theron mm-hmm. comedy. So like, Like the dynamic of their relationship, I think, is reflected in the screenplay, and that there are moments that feel very witty and urbane and like there's sparkling banter. And then there are some sort of outrageous kind of bodily fluids gags that I thought were pretty smart. And I thought they melded together pretty well, but, you know, clearly we didn't all have to see the same way.
This is a movie where, you know, honestly, we haven't seen a tone like this before. I'm completely open to the fact that because they're doing something different with this, that I may change my mind in 5 or 6 years if I return to it. And I'm like, oh, maybe I didn't understand the tone that they were going for because they're trying to meld two different things. And maybe we just don't see that a lot.
I do want to talk about the Rogan-Theron pairing in terms of, you know, there was this sort of wave of like, ugh, another movie where like a, you know, a goddess is with some, you know, pile of dirt. And I think like the movie is sort of about that very thing and very smartly addresses that. And second of all, like, Seth Rogen is an attractive gentleman. I'm sorry. And
he's not unattractive. Maybe, if I saw those two people together, I would be like, he's probably got a great job.
As universally, exactly.
That really didn't bother me
makes
that
them
much.
Laugh. As Dave pointed out, my husband, Charlize Theron was involved with 21st century Sean Penn in real life. So this is a step up. Frankly,
oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. And also his wife in real life is like incredibly smart and talented and beautiful. Yeah. And you're like...
As Dave also likes to say, if women didn't want to sleep with dudes that look like Seth Rogen, evolution would have gotten rid of them.
I was when I was watching it, I was very wary of if they would like cross the line on the trope of like you see, like we rarely see a woman this successful in a movie where she doesn't really have to. I don't think she really has to change to be with Seth Rogen that much. She kind of like is already like a very good character in her own right who is like struggling against like very real world problems.
Right.
And then Seth Rogen at a couple points in this movie fails up. There's there's parts where this movie where like I would have just wiped my hands and just like walked away, and then she sees the Aurora Borealis and she's like, well, I guess I'll give this guy one more shot.
It has a lot of powers, those Northern Lights.
It's I mean, have you seen them?
Changes you.
I made me want to give a guy another shot.
I think I would have loved to have seen an alternative cut of this movie where she announces his love for Seth Rogen and then loses the election.
Turns out the polling data was right. All right.
Are we going to talk about the thing that we all didn't like?
Yes,
we
please.
Should do that. I assume we're all talking about the final O'Shea Jackson.
Yes,
the reveal.
First of all, so many jokes in this movie. To me, felt like as a comedian and as a person who has. Who knows a bit about the last couple Seth Rogen movies and like the humor that you might be able to see. Like when you get a lot of like, these are super talented people. This cast is amazing. Yeah. These people are all busy and I'm sure they all have crazy schedules. So when they're on set, they're like, let's shoot it this way. Let's shoot it this way. Let's keep it moving, I'm sure. And that is not great for comedy a lot of the times.
Yeah.
It seems like so many of these jokes, especially for someone like O'Shea Jackson, who is not a comedian, who is very charismatic for sure, but like it seems like a lot of these jokes were just like pitched off camera, just like, hey, O'Shea, say this, and then roll, and then, we got a great job, O'Shea. You know what I mean? So the joke we all do not like is 80 minutes into the movie where it's revealed that O'Shea Jackson is a black Republican.
Black Christian Republican.
A black Christian Republican. Christian, fine, but black Republican, no thank you. No.
And it underscores this whole, again, the sort of the Act Three thing of where Rogan has to sort of learn that even though he's this sort of firebrand liberal, that really he needs to be more understanding and there needs to be more sort of like, you know, reaching across the aisle, sort of kumbaya bullshit, which the last couple of years have shown us is a crock. Because, you know, you have an entire party that is supporting a criminal and allowing him to do whatever as long as they get to maintain power. And, you know, as some pundit has pointed out, Obama was wrong. We do live in a blue America and a red America. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter now of who wins.
That reveal, I think I felt my stomach drop.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, angry. Fuck, is this where it's going? Are you fucking serious?
Because they never tell you what party the president or Charlize Theron are in. They leave it to you to sort of figure that out. out. This is the only time in the movie that like specific partisanship is even mentioned.
And that would have been if they kept that the whole way through, that it's like we're never, it's like, look, you want to play it soft with politics, that's fine. But then to get so explicit on that, and it just felt like such the like, no, we have to make sure we're reaching out to both sides kind of thing. And it also is bullshit for where the rest of the actual point of the movie is. It felt like one of the other issues I had with the movie is like they couldn't decide is it Seth Rogen's story or her story. And hers to me was a lot more interesting. Mm-hmm. And her ultimate message is, no, stick to your guns and what you believe in. Don't just try to believe that both sides are equal and you should like cater to like the, oh, well, I'm going to give up this thing I believe in because it's for the greater good. Like, no, I should stick to my guns. So to have hit the scene where you know what? You should actually stop believing in what you believe in, Seth Rogen.
Yeah. And we even get a villain who is clearly Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, who is obviously, if he's got leverage over the president, he probably would have in either case. But clearly this character is meant to be the only other stated Republican in the movie.
Yeah.
So for the O'Shea Jackson character, it's like, what?
Yeah, Andy Serkis.
Yes.
Thank God Andy Serkis is in this movie for me personally. he feels like a different person, which you could say about any Andy Serkis role. But I do not think he's very well utilized.
No.
I can't remember how the arc even ends.
Speaking of bad jokes, they didn't give him jokes. Literally, he shows up in the same scene and has almost the exact same dialogue every time. Like, that was one where I'm like, oh, you guys, another one kind of phoned that part in.
It's such a weird movie for me. Like, it's okay for one thing if you're going to be soft, like, politically, but, like, this movie starts with a Nazi scene. I forgot about it, but it's like pretty intense, actually. This is why I kind of think the movie was written maybe like in 2015.
Well, I think the Nazi scene, I was thinking about this later. The reason it's there is so that if Rogan's character was merely sort of an op-ed blowhard, then it would be harder to sort of equate him to Charlize Theron as somebody who's really good at their job and really devoted to their job. Mm-hmm. Showing him go undercover and risk getting murdered, I think, kind of sets his character up as being a genuine journalist, you know, who's like pounding the pavement and doing the hard stuff and not just sitting at a word processor being like, oil companies suck, you know.
I feel like there was, I mean, this could be expressed by just like seeing that scene, maybe, but like there was never any like real anti-Nazi like messaging. I mean, I'm not saying it's pro-Nazi at all, but I feel like
Jewish,
if you show,
I think it's pretty
like,
5 minutes.
Are you saying that the movie is pro-Nazi?
I'm not saying that the movie is pro-Nazi. But if you have a 10-minute scene with Nazis, I think you should at least like in the scene after be like, fuck these Nazis, right? Can we publish this article?
I think they were pretty clear on that. And we got a great Ariana Grande joke out of it.
Yeah, and it is him giving the finger to them, running away saying the Jews win this one, which I thought was actually a good line.
I think we're talking about like the opening of the scene. I really do think that was written by Dan Sterling, and I feel like I can guarantee you that this script was written after the interview, and then they realized that Charlize Theron was coming on. Liz Hanna, the other writer of this, was working with Charlize at her production company for a long time, and so my guess is Charlize was like, if I'm coming onto this project, you have to have a woman write things that make a woman seem normal or interesting. And I have a feeling that she tried to put in some story that actually makes sense. And I can see that struggle.
I can see that.
I would totally see
against
that.
Because have you guys seen the interview?
Yes. Yeah.
So I can see and I can feel Liz Hanna trying to.
Yeah.
And she, you know, obviously a guest on Switchblade Sisters, so we've talked a lot
that's
about.
That's right. I worked with Dan
structure.
Sterling for years, so it's fine.
I did one of the scenes that I and. One of the few scenes that I enjoyed was the scene with them dancing. That was really sweet. And scenes like that where I'm like, yeah, these guys have great chemistry. We know that they can both be comedy. I mean, Charlize Theron, we've seen... What was that comedic movie she did with Patton Oswalt?
Oh, Young Adult.
Young Adult.
Which I loved, yeah.
That movie was fantastic.
She's fucking hilarious. And also Tully.
Yeah.
And she's just really funny,
She commits to everything that she's in, and I just kind of feel like everyone deserved a little bit better than the direction of this movie, and some of the more broad choices that were in this movie. Ultimately,
I wanted that scene that you're talking about with them dancing, though. I do want to make sure that we point that out, that there's a really wonderful sweetness to their relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those were the scenes where I was just like, yeah, I would like to live here a little bit longer.
Yeah. It's pretty it's like great. The middle 45 minutes of that movie is yeah. actually really
it's
nice
really
and
It's really thoughtful
sweet.
And yeah. really sweet.
It's like, I think you can draw some real world comparisons to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. People have been yes. talking about her boyfriend
I think
recently.
He's cute too. I just saw him in Knock Down
yeah.
the House.
I'm sure
he's a dorky ginger. That's high on my dance card.
He supports her. He makes her happy. And he doesn't compromise her. Powerful job.
Yeah,
and
the movie never makes her apologize for being smart or powerful.
Nope.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't like have to adorably fall down, mm-hmm. which, you know, he falls down. He does the falling down.
The inversion
yeah.
of that.
No, that yeah.
it's,
nice.
So it's never that shtick at all, which I really appreciate.
It. Yeah.
If you're a diehard fan of Charlize or Seth Rogen, you know, now's your chance to go see it. It flopped. I think it was made for $40 million and made about 12 or 16. I mean, everything's flopping right now.
Yeah. Everything yeah. died in the wake of the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah, that's the real end game right there.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it made $10 million domestic in the box office, mm-hmm. and then three came from the
I was hoping, I mean, look, I like rom-coms, and I think when they're mm-hmm. done well, they're up there with any other genre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was exciting to have Crazy Rich Asians last summer, mm-hmm. and I want good things for this movie, and I want more movies like this.
I like trends in it. I personally didn't enjoy it, but the three other people in the theater that I was in did, which is great. And thank you for joining me here on this podcast, you guys. what do you guys think? Would you screen it, stream it, or skip it?
Oh, I 100% screen it. I loved this film. I had a great time. Mm-hmm. I share you the qualms about the Black Republican and a few other things, but for the most part, I thought this nailed exactly what it wanted to be. I loved watching the two of them together, and I had a blast.
I'm going to go with stream it. If you, because this is exactly the kind of movie that I 100% would have, if I had watched it in my living room on a Saturday night, I would have enjoyed it ever so slightly more with those lowered expectations and efforts. So, I think it's perfect stream it because there's enough good that you will enjoy your time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same for me. Stream it.
Okay. I'm going to say skip it. I'm going to say straight up somersault over this movie. I guess that is the end of the discussion for this movie, and we'll be back in a second with our fun phone calls to friends. I know that's not the segment name, but hey, I'm new. we're gonna take a break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm the JV Club podcast, Janet Varney, and I used to suffer from indecision. I couldn't choose between Star Wars and Star Trek, whether to call or text, or the best way to cook my eggs. But now, thanks to my weekly dose of We Got This on Maximum Fun, my decisions are made for me. Thanks, Mark and Hal.
Warning, We Got This may cause shouting, phone throwing, the illusion that the hosts can hear you, laughter on public transit, and death.
We Got This with Mark and Hal. We know what's best.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your guest host, Brody Reed. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Brendan Hay,
April Wolf.
Now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot Line. Today's call is from Matilda from Ventura, California. Let's play a call.
Hi, this is Matilda calling from Ventura, California. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and one of my pet peeves in movies is movies that really get school or teachers or kids wrong, like where the classroom has 10 kids, or the teacher is a saint, or the kids most often are either obnoxiously precocious or unrealistically innocent and angelic and kind of maybe dumb in that way. So I was wondering, what are your favorite school movies? Thanks. Bye.
Favorite school movies.
Ooh. Okay, I'm gonna go on a deep cut here. There's a French movie called The Class, which is about a teacher dealing with coming to a new school. It's one of the rougher neighborhoods of Paris. It's a racially mixed class. mostly working class and just sort of like figuring out how to even try to break through to them and manage, you know, their own stuff that they bring into the classroom with them. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting film, and it's very unsentimental. Like, I'd say The Class and Election are mm-hmm. probably like some of the least sentimental movies about teaching school. Like, The Election is about how teachers mostly hate their students, which is why it makes it so true.
Yeah. I'll jump in with along those lines for not too sentimental and somewhat getting a different teacher student dynamic is Edge of 17, which yeah. I really dug and really liked. One of the things was how it walks the line of how a teacher can be both a mentor and an adversary. And it mm-hmm. kind of goes back and forth of like they also really annoy the fuck out of each other, the teacher and the student in that movie. And it's just nice to see.
Which is true of most student teacher
exactly.
relationships.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to go with To Sir With Love, but I think I'm going to stick with The Faculty.
Oh, that's on brand.
Both of them. You got Sidney Poitier and To Sir With Love and that amazing song by, what is it?
Lulu.
Lulu. Mm. Great song. Great. But also just Sidney Poitier is just,
yes.
He's just like, can be in any movie. I'm like, oh, instantly watchable. This is quite good, quite good. And then, yeah, but The Faculty, wow, you guys.
Yeah.
It's been a long
it's
time.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
I got to rewatch it myself.
Best
Very
use
realistic.
Of a paper cutter I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
My favorite school movie, definitely School of Rock, 100%.
Oh,
seen it like a dozen times when I was definitely too old for it as well, too. I was maybe like 17.
Did you see the Broadway musical?
I did not see the Broadway musical. I did not know there was one until you just told me, and I am going, I booked a ticket to New York.
I wonder if our caller likes any of the movies that we like. I wonder if they're the ones that are her triggers where she's like, the faculty is not real.
That bullshit. Somebody on Twitter was asking about today about like favorite teacher movies, and I was reminded about there's an old Betty Davis movie called The Corn is Green, mm-hmm. which is okay, but I'm a bigger fan of the remake that George Cukor did in the 70s for TV with Katharine Hepburn, and it's on DVD from Warner Archive, and she plays a school teacher who shows up in I think it's a Welsh or Irish mining town, and of course there's like this one amazing kid who like, you know, has the poet in him, but of course are they going to send him down the mine instead? And it is kind of hokey, but like she's, you know, very straightforward, and I think there's it doesn't get too sticky.
There's, I mean, sometimes I like the ones that just go like tits to the glass weird because it is hard to kind of portray what it's like in school. Like Rock and Roll High School is to me this is what high school is, you know? Like
as realistic as Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
My mom was an elementary school teacher for 35, 40 years, and the one that she always liked was Conrack. 1970s John Voight film.
Yeah, based on the Water is Wide, which was the first Pat Conroy novel.
Exactly.
Okay.
So she always swore by that as an elementary school teacher.
Good one.
So yeah, all for that. I only vaguely remembered from childhood.
I think it got remade under the name The Water is Wide for like as like a Hallmark Hall of Fame years later. Yeah.
Oh.
I hope our caller wasn't talking about like Kindergarten Cop and then we and then we went like deep cuts. But I hope so. When I think of school movies, like I get really personally tired of the trope where you see like white teacher goes into like inner city school and like teaches them like poetry is like a new way to rap or something. I personally, and I hope this for my career and life goal, to star in some movie where I go to like some prep school. And I like do teach them how to rap. That'd be pretty fun.
When I don't know if you saw when Lin-Manuel Miranda hosted Saturday Night Live, they did a sketch like that. Well, not like that exactly, but where he comes in and he's like, you know who else used to rap? Shakespeare. And they're like, yeah, we've heard it before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Shakespeare invented rap. That is definitely true.
Just ask Michelle Pfeiffer.
He invented rap because he invented making up words.
Rhyming and stealing.
That we still use, yeah.
He was really good at that, though.
He was really
good.
Thank you, everyone, Thank you to everyone who has called in. There are still some we haven't gotten through, and we will definitely play them on the show. I guarantee it. I won't be here.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
I absolutely promise you. So please keep calling in with questions. The number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664.
And be like Matilda, keep it brief.
Keep it brief. Now it's time for some staff picks. It could be any movie, in theaters, streaming, what have you. Who would like to start?
Oh, me. I'll go.
Oh, yeah.
Ava DuVernay's distribution company, Array, has picked up a film out of Africa called The Burial of Kojo, and it is streaming on Netflix right now, so you can watch it. And we don't get a lot of African cinema in this country, and this is a really gorgeous film. It's basically told from a young woman's point of view. It has kind of a... There's a magical realism aspect to it in terms of, it's a film from Ghana. She's telling this story about her father, her parents' relationship, and her father getting involved in this sort of scheme with, you know, his brother that goes wrong. And it has this kind of dreamlike quality. I actually watched it kind of late at night, and it was a fitting. Like, I never nodded off or anything, but it takes you to kind of these dreamy spaces. And it's really lovely to look at. And it's the kind of movie where because it is shot on, you know, it's on locations. It's not like they built, it's not in sound stages or on sets or whatever. So it gives you a little taste of what life in that country is really like. And so never having been to Ghana, it was nice to sort of just see what, like, you know, streets and houses and things like that were like. And it's 80 minutes. So, you know, you can be
always
all fancy with a foreign film and be out of there in under an hour and a half.
Oh, God. Foreign films are, like, so good for going short because they don't really have to care about international ambitions.
Exactly.
It's great. It's so cool. I just want to see all of them.
So, yeah, The Burial of Kojo, K-O-J-O. Check it out on Netflix.
I'll jump in next.
Please.
My staff pick is Under the Silver Lake.
Aha!
So it got a lot of mixed reviews, and then saw a bunch of critics I like, including Matt Singer, talking about it online, so gave it a shot this weekend and actually really dug it and was kind of surprised by the muted response to it. It reminded me, I've seen people calling it like The Long Goodbye, which I get a little bit in the sense that it's a little slow, a little sprawling, but it actually
reminds me...
And very L.A., that is true. It reminded me more, though, of the author Jonathan Lethem. If, like, he...
That must be why I didn't like it.
That's also totally fair.
I was like, oh, okay, yeah.
It reminded me a lot of one of his books, which I tend to enjoy, and it is sprawling and long and definitely not for everybody, but the opposite of 80 minutes, the 2 hours and 20 minutes went by pretty quickly for me, and I, scene to scene, just really enjoyed it. It is one I'm not sure if I revisit it will hold up a whole ton, but scene to scene, I was pleasantly surprised and thought Andrew Garfield was... walked the line well of being intriguing and not yet particularly likable, but still always intriguing.
Did you see it projected or on VOD?
VOD.
Me too. I'm just curious. Because it did get a little... It's weird. Like, it played at Cannes last year. It was supposed to be a bigger deal.
Yeah.
And then sort of wound up, you know, it got a scant theatrical, but you can now get it on... You can rent it on Amazon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it'll become legend, you know?
Yeah.
It might.
Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, movie I'm picking is one that also was very divided. So, you know, a lot of you might hate it. It's 2012 Sightseers from Ben Wheatley. And it is my kind of romantic comedy. It is dark
I
as
love
fuck.
Sightseers. It's great. Criterion now.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say, I don't know, is it on the Criterion Channel? I didn't look for it yet. Okay, so it's on the Criterion Channel. I was hoping that it was. I'm glad that you know that. And Alice Lowe, who's one of my fucking favorite actresses and writers and directors, she did Prevenge. So any of you guys who saw Prevenge. Please check out Sightseers. It is... It is darker than Prevenge, and it is so weird, and it is about this couple, kind of this couple, and they go on this trip, but it turns out to be a murder spree, and they also might kill each other. It's really psychologically intense, but also darkly funny, and I highly urge people to check out Sightseers.
Yeah.
I've seen two or three Ben Wheatley movies, and I did not care for them.
That's the thing.
I'll take your word for it.
This was the one Ben Wheatley movie I did like.
Really?
Yeah, I actually found this kind of the humor. There's this weird dark charm to that movie that I liked a lot more than his other stuff.
Okay. I got it. I think I'm just a Ben Wheatley super fan. And so, you know, like, he's my, like, Jonathan Levin.
Okay, fair enough. There you go. Yeah.
Which, like, fair enough, to each their own.
Yeah. I'm going to recommend a movie that came on it's on HBO right now, and not a lot of people are talking about it, which is pretty sad. I saw it myself at Sundance and really loved it. It's called Native Son. It's based on the novel by Richard Wright. It was directed by Rashid Johnson, who is amazing. And if you're not familiar with the novel, it's about this young kid named Bigger Thomas who lives in Chicago. It's a very interesting choice and very lines up aesthetically for me. He's just this black punk and dresses very punk through the whole movie. He, like, kind of, you know, classic thing of, like, rebelling against society. And then he gets this job as a chauffeur for an affluent man and then strikes up a crazy relationship with his daughter. And if you know the twist of the book, like, something very dramatic happens, and then Bigger is kind of on the run for the rest of the movie. And it's beautifully shot. It stars Ashton Sanders, which you would know from Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And I expected way more people to be talking about this movie, but I saw it was on HBO, and then it just kind of went by, and everyone's just watching Game of Thrones.
But HBO dumps things. Like, they just, yeah. I feel like it's the same thing with Netflix, though. Like, mm-hmm. because The Tale came on HBO last year, and no one watched The fucking Tale.
But that got at least written about more, like, when it aired. I think more critics. Like,
really?
I saw reviews of Native Son out of Sundance, and they never heard a peep about it again. Mm. I only knew it came on HBO because I saw the one random LA billboard. Mm-hmm. And even then, I think, like, when it premiered, it was on at, like, 10 o'clock at night.
Because I have not heard a single thing about Native Son.
I actually didn't know it got released yet.
I can understand why they didn't release it to theaters, because there is one scene that, like, if they had released it in theaters, people would be talking about it, which is, I think, they should have. It's pretty interesting. I'll just say a murder happens. That's all I have to say. But I highly recommend it if you've got HBO. I know you do. Everyone does.
Is it on HBO Go, HBO Now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome.
I think that about wraps it up for what we
not just yet, Madam, something to say.
Oh, yeah. So I will sadly be taking a hiatus from Who Shot Ya for about 6 weeks because I have to work on a personal project that's going to take me out of the country for a little while. Mm-hmm. So it prevents me from coming into the studio and seeing new movies for just a little bit. So I greatly apologize for having to take that break. Even though I'm leaving, Drea will be filling in, so Yay! You will have some wonderful insights from another Midwestern woman. But I think you'll be excited about what I'm working on, and I'll tell you when I can tell you.
Well, we're very excited for you.
Hiatus, unlike hiatus, hiatus April, mm-hmm. unlike hiatus Ricky, is absentee. Yeah.
I also have to make a special announcement. I will be leaving the show. This is my first and last show.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm locking the door.
Oh boy. Moving on to reviews. If you can, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on the air. Who wants to read this one?
This is from Baby Elephant GIFs, or GIFs, depending on who you are. I started listening to Who Shot Ya for my weekly dose of Ricky Carmona after Wham Bam Pow went off air, and I'm staying for Drea Clark's bubbly enthusiasm, April's Eeyore-ness, and Alonzo's avuncular jolliness. As an immigrant brown person living in the Western world, it's wonderful to have this diverse crew decoding references that might pass me by. It's also my guide to discovering movies. Ricky, I will miss you in your coconut popcorn, and I wish you all the luck in the world.
Oh, thank you. Baby Elephant GIFs.
We're going to find out that they're like, taking my review off. It's GIFs.
That's hilarious. Brendan, hey, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything to plug? You're working on so many cool things.
I do. Oh, thanks. I do want to plug a new season of Harvey Girls Forever hits Netflix on Friday, May 10th.
Awesome.
So please watch it. And also, yeah, if you want to check out the boy band numbers from there, the band's name is Crush For You, and there's a little, if you Google them, there's a little mini site with all their songs to download.
Is that number 4?
Yeah. Come on. Yeah.
Damn, well, it better be.
If you
want to
call me an asshole.
And if you want to keep in touch with me, you can listen to me talk shit about the industry on my Twitter, which is at AyoBroBro, AyoBroBro, and keep it keep an eye out for my future podcast, The Dark Weeb. If you love anime and like to see cool people talk about anime, then wow. Please listen to us, because you are very rare. Thank you so much. Alfonso, April, thank you for joining me.
That's Alfonso Durante.
I'm so sorry.
Alfonso Durante. Please come back.
Thank you for holding my hand as
Brody,
I
thank
do
you
this.
For being here. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. If you guys have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/ WhoShotYaPod. /? Well, I'm not taking that back. Or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Whoshotya line is again WSY 803-1664. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. I love you personally.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.